You know, it worked out okay that Lozo and I didn't talk about Dennis Weidman yesterday. The suspension came down towards the end of the podcast, and I think having a show dedicated to a 20-game suspension in the National Hockey League is probably a good idea. So it's me, Greg. Merrick unfortunately couldn't be here today. He's got some personal stuff to deal with, but he'll be back post haste. But Dennis Weidman, most likely not going to be in the National Hockey League for a good chunk of the rest of the season. 20-game suspension, obviously double what we thought. And we're going to have a couple people on the show today to talk about it. Pat Steinberg coming up, Kent Wilson coming up as well later in the program to talk about the Weidman thing. 20 games, double what we thought. I think most of us thought 10. The way the rule was written, when it comes to making contact with an official, it seemed like it was going to be more of the, hey, got his bell rung, didn't really know what he was doing, no intent to injure, put his hands on an official, kind of 10 gamer, kind of fit in that category. But the NHL went with 20. The NHL went with 20 because of reasons. I mean, by the letter of the law, they're basically saying that Weidman had intent to injure in that moment. And if you're saying that, then you're saying that, well, that Weidman has his wits about him in that moment. And that's going to be the really interesting thing that comes down in this situation because, as you know, the NHLPA went to the table yesterday, Brian Burke in tow, which is fascinating, considering, you know, his former position with the league and all of the entanglements there. Claiming that Weidman was diagnosed with a concussion afterwards, which again is also fascinating because that means that the Calgary Flames did not go through the proper concussion protocol with Dennis Weidman, which means they obviously are going to get fined for it. And the counter argument now seems to be that he didn't know what he was doing. And that Weidman, when he ran into linesman Don Henderson, didn't know what he was doing. There was no intent to injure because he was concussed. Now, the appeal process is going to be ongoing here. The NHLPA announcing last night that they're going to appeal on behalf of Weidman, which was expected. You go 20-game suspension for with a guy, and you expect that there's going to be an appeal. The NHLPA in the appeal writes, "We strongly disagree with the league's decision to suspend Dennis Weidman. Dennis has played in 11 NHL seasons and almost 800 games without incident." I mean, I guess the incident in this case being attacking an official. "The facts, including the medical evidence presented at the hearing, clearly demonstrate that Dennis had no intention to make contact with the linesman. An appeal has been filed on the player's behalf." Contact with the linesman is an interesting phrase, isn't it? Like there's a little bump into a linesman, and then there's what we saw in that clip with Weidman, which is sort of a forceful shove of a linesman. But I mean, you could also argue just, you know, he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't know who the guy was. He didn't know what he was doing. He just wanted to get to the bench, all that jive. And I'm sure that's the case the NHLPA is making. The appeals process goes a little something like this. The first appeal is to Bettman. I can't imagine that this is going to be a situation where he reduces the suspension. I don't see him doing that in this situation, being that I think the 20 games is as much a caveat to the officiating crew in the National Hockey League as it is a punishment for Dennis Weidman. And it would be quite the mixed message if the commissioner comes down and lessens a suspension that his hatchet man, Colin Campbell, handed out. So then we take this thing all the way up to an independent arbitrator, and that's where the fun really starts. Now, I happen to think that the NHL believes, and if you listen to this podcast, you know, Jeff Merrick is very fond of saying that Gary Bettman never walks into a room without knowing exactly what's going to happen in that room. I think the NHL believes this will get knocked down to 10. I think the evidence, as far as the concussion goes, as far as everybody seeing the hit, even with Weidman saying after the game that his neck hurt and his shoulder hurt, but he knew what he was doing. And even with Weidman having his wits about him and to apologize to Henderson, you might be able to get away with saying that in that moment, he was not of sound mind. And if you're not of sound mind, it's kind of hard to establish intent to injure. So I think what's going to happen here, as far as the appeal goes, is that you're going to see it go to the independent arbitrator and the arbitrator knock it down to 10, And then what you have is the National Hockey League being able to tell its officials, hey, well, we tried, did our best, gave them 20. This other thing, this thing that the players, wink, wink, wanted, knocked it down to 10. So you know who has your back in this situation. Joining us now on the line, Calgary Flames, all kinds of stuff, Sportsnet 960 in Calgary. Pat Steinberg joins us now to talk about this and many other things. Pat, how are you doing, sir? It's Greg.
I'm good, Greg. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it, man. Interesting times with the Flames and interesting times with Weidman. I guess the first question is, what was your take on this whole thing coming down yesterday, 20 games for Weidman? More than you expected, and how do you think the appeal is going to shake out?
Well, I got to say, I was stunned, and out here on our station, it was certainly the topic du jour yesterday. I was stunned. You know, I knew that it was going to be a long suspension because of how long it took to come to a decision. I thought, and I was anticipating around 10 games, and I thought 10 games was going to be too long, but when I saw 20, I thought that it was extremely excessive, like beyond excessive, and I'll tell you why. I mean, I really think that, you know, you take a look at that video, and that video, to me, leaves a lot of gray area, leaves a lot of room for benefit of the doubt. And I'm not saying that there was no foul. I'm not saying there was no wrongdoing. And I'm not saying there wasn't a potential that perhaps Weidman overstepped. But the problem is, he says it was accidental. You take a look at the job the guys at Sportsnet have done and kind of blowing up the way his feet pivot right at the last moment. You listen to his explanation. You see the Yannick Weber situation that happened between San Jose and Vancouver in September. You say, you know what? There's a potential that he was surprised, didn't see him, and that was the reaction to seeing him. And so because there's all that gray area, and because I believe there's room for benefit of the doubt, I thought 20 games is excessive. 20 games, to me, seems like a suspension that you hand down when there is no benefit of the doubt, when there is no doubt, when there is incontrovertible evidence that this actually happened and there's no room for interpretation. I guess I just saw a ton of room for interpretation, which is why I thought a suspension that's up there with one of the longest in NHL history was maybe a little excessive, in my eyes, quite a bit excessive. As for the appeal, I was listening to you on the way in. I think your read on it's right, and I think there's even a potential of the NHL kind of knew that was the way it was going to go, too. There's probably going to get knocked down an appeal. You know, in 2014, Dan Carcillo got 10, got it knocked down to 6. So if this is 20 and they knock it down to 12 or 10, that wouldn't surprise me. And that's kind of what I'm anticipating. I don't anticipate this to end up being 20 when it's all said and done. If it's closer to the low double digits, that's kind of more what I'm anticipating.
Yeah, and it's the Yannick Weber situation is an interesting one. That video was floating around everywhere yesterday of Weber in the preseason, basically delivering a flying shoulder tackle to John Henderson during the preseason and getting absolutely nothing for it, which I guess is they didn't think there was any intent there or anything, but I wonder if that's going to show its face in the arbitration process as well.
Well, I think it probably should. I know they're not identical situations, and one of them, Henderson is facing Weber in the one with Weidman. His back is to Dennis and all that. But, you know, I still think there's a lot of similarities in that both players in both instances had any idea the official was there. I truly believe that Weidman didn't know the official was there until too late. Saw him, put his arms up, and that's what happened. Now, that's my interpretation, and I know there are plenty of people who interpreted, you know, the exact opposite. But, you know, we don't know. Now, the only person who really knows is Dennis Weidman. But you take a look at the Weber situation, and you take a look at how it happened there, same thing. You know, official gets, I don't want to say in the way, but in the path of the Canucks defenseman, he's surprised, and the first instinct is to put the arms up to brace, and next thing you know, Don Henderson's on the ice. And the very least, the reaction of the players, Weber and Weidman, are somewhat similar, which I think adds even more credence to the potential that, you know, Dennis Weidman is telling the truth, that this was not an intentional thing, this was incidental and accidental. So yeah, if I'm the PA going to appeal, I absolutely am showing that video. Even though it's not identical, I think there are similarities that can help your case.
Now, I'm not necessarily one to carry water for the league when it comes to player safety, but I got to admit that when it comes to precedent and this situation, And they acknowledge the concussion thing in their official video on the suspension. When it comes to precedent in this situation, I kind of get it. I kind of get the idea of a player injuring an official and then saying after the fact, well after the fact, that it was a concussion that made it all kind of foggy and wonky and weird. Like, that's a Pandora's box, man. That's a defense, if they were to accept it in this situation, that could really undercut player safety in this league going forward. So I get why you ignore it if it's the league.
Well, and I mean, what makes matters more interesting is Weidman's back practicing with the team. He's allowed to practice during his suspension, and he's back practicing with the team, which I think adds another wrinkle to it. You're right. The fact that in the NHLPA's release, when they put out their appeal and the reason why, they mentioned the medical things that they brought up in the hearing, and then the NHL in their video mentions that, yeah, we acknowledge that he was concussed and all of that. I mean, to me, that does throw a whole new wrinkle into everything, and I think it's a really interesting thing to kind of watch going forward. And the word that you use, Pandora's box, I think that's exactly accurate, because, okay, well, what happens next? I mean, does that mean the next time that there's an incident like this that you can claim that you're concussed? Does that mean that, you know, the Flames aired? I mean, there's been reports out there that the concussion spotter did call down, but it was ignored. And Dennis Weidman has repeatedly said that he ignored medical attention. I mean, I think it definitely opens up a whole lot more. And now you're trying to figure out, okay, well, did the Flames air? Does that put Weidman on the hook because he refused the medical attention and all of that? So I don't like the way that goes for the league and for the team if that continues to be a story. But, you know, I think that in the NHL's defense, and it's the one area that I think that I would agree with them on, is by not really, you know, not really giving that a whole lot of credence or not using it necessarily as an excuse is probably the way to go, just because of what you said. It's because, you know, he did refuse medical attention, and you don't want to open up that Pandora's box.
Yeah, and obviously all of this happens with the shadow of the concussion lawsuit looming over it, and I think like 13 or 14 more players joined it within the last week too, including Grant Ledyard. The Flames, sir. Let's talk about the Flames for a second. Now we're talking about a team 9 points out of a playoff spot. 9 points out of the wild card, I should say. 6 points out of the third place spot in the Pacific. Reasonable, realistic chance this team could rally in the second half?
I mean, I got to be honest, there's not a whole lot that I've seen this year that speaks to, oh, definitely they're going to rally. They're just a team waiting to break out. But I will say they entered the month of December after a pretty dreadful first 2 months of the season and won 9 of 13 in December, set a brand new home ice winning streak record when they won 11 games at the Scotiabank Saddledome, and, you know, didn't really see that coming at the time either. So is there a chance? Yeah, I think there's a chance, and I think there's always an opportunity, especially in the Pacific Division, which is just not a very good division. There's always a chance that they can rally, and, you know, to the Flames' credit, they do have a lot of Pacific Division games in February. I think the month of February is going to be crucial. They started it on Wednesday night with a big 4-1 win over Carolina. They needed that. They lost three in a row and in pretty, you know, uninspiring fashion heading into the All-Star break. So they got out to a good start after the All-Star break, winning their first game. But I look at it and I look at the rest of the division. I do think for the Flames, the wild card spot's kind of out of the question. 9 points, and the Central Division is just a step above the Pacific. There's no doubt about that. So I think if the Flames are going to get in, it's going to be the same way they got in last year as the number three seed in the division. And the problem is the way Anaheim's playing right now, after their dreadful start, they're starting to score, and the Ducks look like the team, a whole lot closer anyway to the team that got to game 7 of the Western Conference final. San Jose has been really, really good this year, and they're one of the, I honestly believe they're one of the kind of surprise stories of the year this league. I mean, this year, they're a good team. Pavelski's scoring, they're getting decent goaltending from Martin Jones, and they've had Calgary's number this year, and they've got a decent lead. And then you've got Arizona and Vancouver ahead of the Flames in the mix as well. So it's just, yes, they could rally. Yes, they could make it close. But with all those teams they'd have to leapfrog, and with all those teams that have more of a leg up on them in the Pacific, I do think it's going to be unlikely that they make the playoffs. But I do think there's a chance that they can put together a decent month of February and at the very least make the final couple months or month and a half of the season somewhat interesting. The problem is, you know, we're about 3 weeks or whatever it is away from the trade deadline, and this team's got some decisions to make. You wonder if they're close to the playoffs at the deadline, does that make things even more complicated for them? If maybe they're a little further back, maybe it allows them to make the moves that a lot of people think they should be making.
And that would, and that would take a hell of a run in the next, like, 2 weeks for them to even be in that position. You know, it's funny. You bring up two things I want to comment on. The first is the Sharks. I actually had the Sharks in the playoffs because, as a Devils fan, I know what Pete DeBoer gets out of your team in year one. It's not necessarily going to be the same thing in year two or three, and by year three, he's probably on his ass. But in year one, that guy can get a team playing. And the other thing, too, is, you know, you mentioned the Pacific Division. How dare you, sir? How dare you besmirch the good name of a division that just skated away from the All-Star game with a check for $1 million? Now, granted, Captain John Scott, not in the Pacific anymore, clearly the difference maker, but by golly, did they ever have an impressive showing at the All-Star game?
Well, there's some really good players in the Pacific Division, but the teams they play on, other than the Los Angeles Kings, are not what you... And you know what? Give San Jose and Anaheim credit. They're playing really well. And I do think the run that San Jose's gone on over the last month and a bit and the run that Anaheim has gone on over the last month and a bit has maybe made the Pacific Division start to look a little bit more like the way it should. I mean, through the calendar year 2015 of this season, like, it was dreadful. You had the Oilers, the Flames were off to an awful start. San Jose was okay. Vancouver was okay. Anaheim couldn't score for their lives. And then you have the LA Kings who are like, hey, we're up here. We'll see you later. Talk to us when you get to round two of the playoffs. Like, it really has been a tough division this year. I do think a couple of teams are starting to make it look a little bit better, which is good. I'm just not sure the Flames are necessarily one of those teams that is going to boost the division when it's all said and done. And you're right on Pete DeBoer. I mean, year one with the Devils, where do they go? They go to game six of the Stanley Cup final against those Kings. And I think he's done a really good job. They needed a change of scenery in a lot of ways. I love what Todd McClellan did there, and I love what Todd McClellan is probably going to do in Edmonton. But I think it's time for a change for both him and for the team. So you bring in a guy like Pete DeBoer who has got himself a pretty decent track record, and you go out, you get a goaltender that, you know, you can maybe trust for the next 5 or 10 years, and you still have some of those players that can get the job done. San Jose, I think, is going to be a playoff team too, and they look like a group that should be in the postseason when it's all said and done.
And finally, you know, it'd be remiss if we didn't speak about point per game player Johnny Hockey, Johnny Gaudreau, and boring Sean Monahan, who just had a 4-point night the other night. You know, in a season that has been more lowlights than highlights, sir, I think these two players have certainly been the highlight for Calgary.
No doubt about it, and Gaudreau especially. The right now, there's two MVPs on this team, and one of them is Johnny Gaudreau, no doubt about it. And it's funny, the other guy is not the other All-Star. And Mark Giordano has been great for him, especially of late. But the way TJ Brody has played this year, he has been instrumental to this team, you know, even being close to playoff consideration. And he was out for the first month or so of the season. The record with him, and I believe they're 5 games above 500 with Brody in the lineup. They were 5 games below 500 without him in the lineup. He has been instrumental, but Johnny Gaudreau is just so fun to watch. And it's been a long time in Calgary since Jerome McGinley's heyday, but you've been able to go into a game and know that there's a player that, hey, he's worth the price of admission. Every single night at the Saddle Dome, he does 1, 2, 10, 12 things. You're like, holy cow, like that, most guys in this league can't do that. You know, for instance, the pass he made on the fourth goal the Flames scored on Wednesday night against Carolina to Sean Monahan to complete his 4-point game. Very few players in this league are completing that pass and making that pass. He's been unbelievable, and in year two, to be doing this with even more attention on him right from the get-go is pretty impressive. He's seeing top pairings. He's seeing top shutdown forward units every single night, and he's still getting the job done. And he's going to come away with more points this year than he had in his rookie season. And now that Monahan game against Carolina, that's encouraging because he's kind of been up and down, and he's been a little maligned here in Calgary because last year 30 goals, part of one of the best lines in the league in the second half of the season with Gaudreau and Yuri Hudler. And this year, you know, he's been really good at times. Had some really good games, but he's had stretches where the points haven't been there, where it's clear that he's not as impactful. So to see him get four and to see him have a game where you could just tell right from the get-go of that game on Wednesday night that he was going to be an impact maker, that hopefully bodes well for this team. And Hudler had a couple of points on that line too, and he's really struggled this year. And if he can have a little bit more success with that line once again, which he really hasn't been a part of for most of the season, if he can have more success playing with those two guys, that'll really bode well for Calgary if they're going to try and mount an attack and get themselves back into the picture.
Yeah, and I'll go you one step further on that comparison to Ginla for Gaudreau. I go Theo Fleury. I think as far as guys that just electrify you every time they touch the puck, that might be the next guy that I would think of as far as comparisons go, as far as price of admission.
It's probably true. And I mean, the comparisons between the two guys, I mean, Fleury was a little feistier and certainly brought a little bit more of that edge than Gaudreau does. Gaudreau probably has more pure skill and playmaking ability than Fleury did. And yeah, I think there's really only been a handful of guys in Flames history who have done that. I mean, Ginla for sure in his prime did. When he had the puck, he just knew that there was a chance something could happen. In those 90-point years, Jerome Ginla was one of the four or five best players on the planet. Fleury before that, probably point to, you know, Håkan Loob for a little while there. Kent Nielsen at the beginning of the franchise in the early 80s. But, I mean, there haven't been a lot of guys that have just naturally brought Flames fans into their seat and been worth the price of admission on their very own. But definitely right now, Gaudreau is that. He's been that good this year.
For sure. And Fleury and Gaudreau also, of course, share a bizarre affinity for country music. Pat, you're a gentleman and a scholar. We appreciate you being on the show today and bringing some smarts about the Flames, and we'll talk to you down the line.
Hey, Greg, appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Take care, man. Pat Steinberg, bringing that Sportsnet smarts on the radio out in Calgary. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think a lot's going to be written now that Connor's back about the Pacific Division and the chances that somebody can jump up and grab that third seed. Because I agree. I can't imagine the Sharks falling out of the playoff picture. They have 56 points right now, which means they are a clear five ahead. Well, actually, three ahead of Arizona. But I think the Sharks are a quality team. And not just because they're on a bit of a streak right now, a bit of a hot streak right now. But, you know, Anaheim's the one that we're all looking at. 7-3 in their last 10. They seem to have their offense figured out a little bit now. And now the pressure's on Arizona to keep pace. And the news that Mike Smith's going to be out for a little bit longer, obviously, is good news to that end. And then it's going to be up to a Calgary or an Edmonton to make a hell of a run. And listen, man, you know, stranger things have happened. Look, after Ottawa does what they did last year with Andrew McDonald in goal, stranger things have happened as far as teams making a hell of a run of it in the second half. And if you had to pick one team to do it, wouldn't it be Edmonton? It's the confluence of finally kind of figuring out defense a little bit better, and obviously Connor coming back and being able to make some magic happen as he pushes for the Calder and tries to elevate this team to the playoffs. I know the Calder's not supposed to be rookie MVP. Oilers get in the playoffs, Connor's going to win the Calder if his stats are anywhere near the top of the standings for rookies. Aren't you kind of pulling for it? I know there's two groups of people that aren't pulling for this. People that don't like the Oilers and people that don't like Canada. Because right now Canada doesn't have a playoff team. And what a time to be alive, huh, Ryan Lambert? But, you know, if you're a fan of hockey, you clearly want McDavid to blow the doors off this thing. You clearly want McDavid to lead the Oilers to the playoff bubble at the very least. And maybe even get in. Because wouldn't it be great if they got in?
and got the hell out of the lottery.
Wouldn't that be better for hockey? To not have them anywhere near the lottery? At all? Ever? Again? I guess the big story today, and we wrote about it on Puck Daddy, is the idea that the Montreal Canadiens, welcome to the lottery. Welcome to the party, pal. As our great friend John McClane said in Die Hard. The idea that now they should tank, which I'm sure is top of mind because Buffalo just beat them. And so you have Tank Nation with Jack Eichel going in and beating the Habs. Ninth loss in 10 games. So the thought is now that they should tank for a higher draft pick. And that's the idea that it's now a stealth tank is something I'm getting behind. You keep Therrien in place. No need to change coaches, re-energize the team. You keep Carey Price out as long as possible. No need to put your MVP Vezina winning goalie in there to help turn this thing around. Just slowly slip down the muddy hill into the bottom of the standings and adjust accordingly in the offseason. That should be the plan. But it's Montreal we're talking about, and they have a thing called pride. Kent Wilson is one of my favorite follows on Twitter, a Flames Nation contributor and a stats guy supreme, one of the big brains that makes hockey fandom better. Although, Kent, don't you lament the fact that we don't have the same number of big brains speaking freely on Twitter that we used to, now that they've all been hired by NHL teams?
Yeah, they're all getting scooped up, which is unfortunate, but I'm sure I'll be around forever, so maybe I'll be the last guy standing.
Nobody reaching out to hire you?
No.
Kent, we were talking, let's start off with the Weidman thing. We talked about it with Pat Seinberg just before, but I want to get your take on it. As the guys watch the Flames a lot, I think you probably know what kind of player Dennis Weidman is. When you saw the 20 games yesterday, what was your reaction?
This whole thing has kind of been really strange and bizarre. I was watching the game at the time, and actually after the incident, I didn't think twice about it. I thought, you know, that's, you don't see that very often, but it seemed relatively incidental to me. He might get in trouble for that, and then it just blew up the next couple of days, and I thought, what the hell is going on here? It's looking at it now, I think the league is using it as a precedent. You know, they talk about disciplinary action depending on precedents, and I think this one is setting one. So it's just the optics of it, looking at what happened. They don't want stuff to come up in the future where guys are hitting refs in vulnerable positions and saying, oh, you know what, I was not my right mind. So even if you could argue, as Dennis Wyman, that he was woozy or didn't really know where he was or whatever his defense, they don't want that coming up in the future. So they're making an example out of them.
So the question then becomes, because I agree with you, that seems to be the take from the NHL is they're trying to establish a situation where players can't use concussions and wooziness as a reason why they act out violently against officials or other players. The question is, we both recognize this. The question is this the right decision? Like, is the slope too slippery on the other side of this thing, where if they let Weidman off lightly because of that defense, that they end up kind of hurting the league in the process? Or is it more of an issue of what's fair to Dennis Weidman in this situation?
It's a good question, just because, you know, Weidman individually doesn't have a history of this. He's not a violent player towards other players most of the time. He didn't even have a motivation to do what he did. He couldn't watch the play and go, oh, I can see why he went after the ref. It was just, that's why it's so strange. And he can have the sort of defense of, well, yeah, I didn't do this on purpose. But I, thinking about it now, I kind of agree with what the league's doing. And I honestly wish they would do it more when it came to the player side of discipline, where they'd get really serious about infractions, none of this 3-5 game stuff. Because if you start handing out very real discipline like this, I think it will affect behavior.
And I mean, as far as the appeals process, let me be on the record here. I love the appeals process, by the way. I love the fact that there is oversight ahead of Bettman. The fact that Bettman was the appellate court in this situation for years was an absolute travesty. I mean, the idea that he's gonna usurp the power of the guy he hired to hand out suspensions was insanity. So I am a fan of the independent arbitrator. But I think in this case, it was pretty guaranteed the NHLPA was going to go down that road. And I also think it's pretty guaranteed the NHL knew it. And I think that that's why they come down hard, knowing that no matter what happens in this situation, A, he'll be punished, and B, the NHL looks like they're the ones who came down hard on him.
Yeah, as you say, it could be an anchoring mechanism for the inevitable appeal. So no matter what happens, he's going to be disciplined heavily, I would say.
Indeed, he will.
Yeah.
You're a guy who I imagine has used NHL.com now and again for certain things.
I have.
We were talking about this on the website on the podcast yesterday with Dave Lozo. What are your thoughts on the revamp of NHL.com as far as how you use it and how you find it to be user friendly these days?
I think it's awful. I don't know what the popular opinion is. I really disliked what they did with the stats update a while ago when they're trying to integrate advanced stats. That area got ugly pretty quickly, and I stopped using it. But now this revamp, the irony is my day job is in digital marketing. So I'm literally sitting next to a guy at his desk who is a website builder. And when I brought up the site yesterday, we went through it and went, here's all the things that are wrong with this in terms of user experience. There's superfluous menus everywhere. It's busy. It's awful.
It is a little rough.
Well,
I'll agree with that. And again, like the stat revamp for me that was a little rough was the fact that it's just the whole filtering system they have now, where it used to be just pull down menus, easy to find everything, and now it's like different layers of filters and menus that have just complicated finding even the simplest stat.
Yeah, and they changed all the nomenclature for some reason. So if you're going there, if you know possession is a Corsi stat, you go there and they've given it some other acronym. And then, as Travis Yost from TSN has pointed out a lot of the numbers aren't even right.
Right,
in the
yeah.
stats on NHL.com. So it's ghastly.
Do you think it's, I mean, you know, we talked about player tracking recently in the sense that the NHL hasn't implemented it yet. The cost is too high. They're waiting on if there's a revamp of the technology. I mean, are we at a point where the only way we're ever going to get all on the same page when it comes to this stuff is with player tracking technology?
I think so, just because, you know, manual tracking of this stuff is hugely time consuming and somewhat subjective. No matter how well you want to define what it is you're tracking, eventually you're going to have some sort of bias, skew the results to some degree. So the funny thing is if I was the NHL teams, this is something I'd be very willing to spend money on to improve intelligence could save you untold millions down the road.
Indeed. Sure. Exactly. It makes too much sense. Two things here I wanted to bug you about today since we have you on. Whenever we talk to anybody who's smart, like Filipovic and Yost and those guys, I always like to ask about the Colorado Avalanche, which to me is the canary in the coal mine when it comes to advanced stats and observable evidence. Where are you on Colorado and this sort of uptick that they've had later in the season after a pretty rough start?
I still think they're pretty lousy. they still can't control play. I mean, they have enough talent on that team that it's going to raise the boat sometimes, but I don't think Waugh really knows what he's doing at an NHL level as a coach and tactician, and it shows in their underlying numbers all the time. It's just they're constantly outshot, they're constantly outchanced, and it's just, you know, you can try to rise above that every so often, but in the end, you're not going to be a good team.
When you say that, though, when you talk about Waugh, like specifically what are the things that bugs you the most about the way he coaches in the National Hockey League?
I haven't actually broken down his systems. I've only looked at the results from a high level just because I'm not a Colorado Avalanche writer or anything. So I would go, there's probably a couple guys I would like to go to and ask and say, what exactly is Waugh doing here to do this? Just because it's, I guess I can speak from a Flames perspective, just because they're also one of those teams that outperform but still have fairly lousy underlying
right.
numbers most
yeah.
of the time. Uh-huh. So Hartley in town, there's sometimes it's personnel decisions, what players are playing where sometimes, like, the Flames opened the season relying very heavily on a counterpunch strategy. So they would block shots, they would collapse into their zone, but when they were breaking out, they went for long passes all the time. So there's guys hanging around at the red line and blue line, and when teams figured that out, they cut them off very easily, and it was 2 or 3 months of absolute pain for the Calgary Flames because they couldn't get out of their own end. So there seems to have been some changes in Calgary towards that, but and maybe those aren't the issues in Colorado, but it's just stuff like that that can lead to you staying in your own end all the time.
Right. And finally, I know you've written a little bit about an issue that we didn't cover too much in this podcast. I don't know why we didn't. It might have hit at a weird time as far as like when we were on the air, off the air, whatever. But the Flames arena situation, and of course the tete-a-tete between the mayor and Gary Bettman. What are your thoughts in general on public funding for arenas, and what did you think about the NHL's getting involved in that situation?
I'm on the side of most economic studies. There is next to no benefit for arenas for cities. You can maybe try to argue the qualitative side of things, that sports teams bring pride and passion and certain things to municipalities. And sure, but there's no way they're worth the $500 million, $1 billion price tags that are being tossed around. And it's crony capitalism to be subsidizing billionaires and millionaires with the common man's taxpayers. So it's bad in principle. It doesn't work. And it's a scourge that should go away in North America.
Especially because there's been arenas that have been built with, you know, like DC, I think, is a great example. I think Poland's the one who built that arena, and, you know, it's thriving and stuff. I don't know. It is a bit of a money grab. I always harken back to when Jesse Ventura was elected governor in Minnesota. An amazing night, by the way. I was working in college at a Blockbuster Video at the time, and I wasn't even paying attention to that race. And then I remember getting in my car and turning on the radio, and all I heard was cheering for like 5 minutes. And all of a sudden I hear this voice come on, and he's like, "It's amazing to be your governor." I'm like, "What the f*** is happening?" So I remember him saying at one point when there was like a hearing about public subsidies for stadia, like the idea, and this I think is a very sort of, you know, libertarian view, the idea that, you know, if you build a library, everybody can go to the library, but if you build a stadium, everybody has to buy a ticket for it, was the idea. and were it only that simple in public funding for stadiums, but I always go back to that idea, which I think is a simple but effective measure of what we use our funding to build and what's it's then used for.
Yeah, the other funny thing about this stuff is the teams don't ever come to the public as an investor or a partner in reality. I mean, the municipalities can borrow money at a lower rate than teams, so maybe there's something you can do there. But they don't come with investment packages. They don't come and say, "We'll split the revenue with you," or "You can have some equity in the team," or something. The things you'd have to do to get private investment in stuff like
right.
this, they don't do with the public. They just say, "Give us the money, and, you know, good stuff's going to happen in the future, maybe, for you. But we're definitely going to get a free arena out of it."
Yeah, exactly. I mean, their selling point to the public is usually do this or we're leaving, which is not necessarily the kind of
too.
Yeah, friendly open negotiation you'd want necessarily with the people that are going to fund your building. But, you know, lo and behold, it's usually what's effective. Kent, man, you're a good dude. Always enjoy reading you, and I'm glad you could join us today for some puck talk. And where can the people find all of your stuff?
I freelance here and there, but it's mostly at flamesnation.ca.
We're part of the Nation Network.
That's
blogs.
It. Used to run
that's
the
right.
whole.
Do you
thing,
hate?
And then I got a real job.
Do you hate the SB Nation blogs? Is there heat between the two blog networks or no?
I don't think so. And actually, I started SB Nation's Matchsticks and Gasoline, so I was the person who came up with that one, and then I moved because I got a bigger paycheck from the other network. So, but I haven't seen any public animosity, at least.
When you worked at SB Nation and you started Matchsticks and Gasoline, did everybody's computer have a screensaver of James Myrtle, just Myrtle smiling as the grand godfather of the SB Nation blogs?
I hope so. I certainly did.
We love Myrtle. All right, dude. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you down the line.
No worries.
Kent Wilson, ladies and gents. Game Show Friday coming up, by the way, in case any of you were wondering. I just call it Game Show Thursday. I don't know what to really call it. Game Show Friday had such a nice cadence to it. I don't think that Game Show Thursday has the same cadence to it, nor the same, you know, like, celebration that, hey, man, weekend's here, have a beer. That's what Game Show Friday always kind of felt to me. It's like the thing that you listen to on the way home, on the subway or in your car. Like, hey, man, Game Show Friday. Boy, oh, boy, this is the official start of my weekend, man. Gonna grab the kids, go to the pool, Game Show Friday. It's good times. We wrote about the jersey we spoke about yesterday on the podcast, the Mark Messier 9/11 Twin Towers as a number 11 jersey is on Puck Daddy today on a special edition of Jersey Fouls, which really needs to be seen to be believed. It's pretty amazing. I'll be at Wild and Rangers tonight, by the way, checking out what's going on with the Wild. Malkin, lower body injury, going to miss probably 2 games. Not a biggie, hopefully. But Eric Fair out a month for the Penguins, the resurgent Penguins. That's about it as far as like, the big old hockey news so far today. Like I said, a lot of the attention is on, the Montreal Canadiens and the possibility of tanking. Although one wonders if they would have the wherewithal to do so, being that they are such a prestigious, team and organization. Again, like, it makes too much sense to do it, but Carey Price skating today, looking a little bit better. He makes his way back. You're just going to get better by default when he gets back into the lineup. So I guess you're kind of stuck there, aren't you? Doing that thing. Whatever. It's fine. Steinberg brought it up before. The Pacific Division, most likely the 3 California teams. The Central Division, you know how that's going to shake out. Atlantic, Metro, both a little up in the air. Who is the great hope to make the playoffs right now if you're one of these Canadian franchises? Is it Ottawa sneaking up? Is it them catching fire in the second half? Go back to the Oilers, man. That'd be super fun if it happened. But I don't know if it will. Like I said, it's asking a lot. It's definitely asking a lot. Although if you're going to do it in any of those divisions, you need to do it in that division. But the wild card race right now is an interesting one in the West, because you've got yourself Colorado with 57, Nashville 56, Minnesota 55, and Arizona 53. Someone's getting left out in the cold over in that Western Conference as far as those Central Division teams all vying for the last 2 wild card spots. Because it's a pretty decent spread between Chicago, Dallas, and St. Louis, and then down to Colorado, Nashville, Minnesota. I did not pick Colorado to, maybe I did I pick them to make the play? I don't think I did. I'm trying to remember who my wild card. Oh, I think I picked the Flames as the wild card team, so don't even listen to me. But I definitely picked the Wild to miss the playoffs. I know that. Took into copious amounts of grief for it. But now maybe I'm real smart. It's time for a Friday favorite on Thursday. That's what the pre-recorded voice said. Joining us down the line, Henry Decker. He's a cop, and he doesn't take any. Henry, it's me, Greg. Merrick is off and about today. But welcome to Game Show Friday on Thursday. You did the smart move. You emailed in and said, "Hey, I never get to be on Game Show Friday because I'm a working man, but I'm on vacation, so why can't I be on Game Show Friday?" And lo and behold, here you are.
Yeah, I figured what better way to spend my rare time off than with the guys who ruined the All-Star game. So sure, let's do it.
We certainly did. Never forget. What do you do when you're not on vacation?
I'm a consultant for nonprofits, so I help charities like spruce up their digital operations, run fundraising campaigns, advocacy campaigns, things like that.
That's a really good gig. Like, consulting is a good gig because undoubtedly the bar is set so low for you to improve anything that's already in place. If they need to reach out to a consultant, it's because their house is such a mess that the minute you come in and you're like, oh, well, why don't we just put this here? They're like, this guy is worth every penny.
Yeah, rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic is actually a specialty of mine.
Indeed it is. All right, Henry. So I take it from the categories you asked for that you're an Islanders fan?
Big time.
We wrote about that today on Puck Daddy. Brett Yormark, the CEO of Barclays Center, really a sterling example of great public relations, moxie, said in a Sports Illustrated interview this week that he understands that there are obstructed seats. Islanders fans understand there are obstructed seats. Everybody should be okay with it, though, because if you are in one of those seats in which you can't see the entire attacking zone or defending zone in front of you, you can just watch the game on your phone. What say you to this new plan from the Islanders?
I mean, I guess it's a good thing that the papers in New York don't care about the Islanders or cover them, because that could be a tabloid disaster. I mean, I think that it's clearly not helpful when you hear stuff like that coming from management, but I tend more towards the pro-Barclays side of the equation. I think a lot of the complaining that happens about the arena is complaining for complaining's sake, and some of it's valid. Like, nobody wants to sit in a seat where you can't see two-thirds of the ice. Some of it is, like, who's ever dropped $100 on a ticket to a hockey game and gone and then seen the scoreboard over the blue line instead of center ice and been like, screw this, I'm going home.
Yeah, and I think the thing about it for me is, like, you know, I agree with you, because as a Nets fan, I was going to Barclays for years before the Islanders arrived, and I think it's a great arena. I think there are some amazing seats there, and I also think the amenities put Nassau to shame. But, like, why can't they just give away those? Like, I know why they can't give away those tickets, because it would be great PR if they did. I know they can't because the capacity is so low that they need to squeeze out every penny they can from every seat in the arena in order to possibly turn a profit. But the idea that, like, you have those seats in the end zones where you can't even see the ice, it would be so much better if they just literally said, you know, line up for these tickets before every game, you know, sit in the crap seats and cheer on your team. I think would be so much better PR than trying to defend those seats by saying, well, there's a jumbotron, what more do you want?
Yeah, that's clearly not helpful. I think there's also something to the fact that they don't really understand hockey fans quite yet. It's new to the market. I think trying to sell basketball tickets to New York transplants in Brooklyn is a very different game than trying to reach Islanders fans who are mainly coming in from Long Island. So it's a learning process for everyone, probably.
Indeed. All right. Henry, you're here to play Game Show Friday on Thursday, and I'm very excited that you're here. You sound like you've got a lot of enthusiasm, which we always like, because, you know, occasionally you get those contestants on, like, The Price is Right, and they're so super nervous, and they can't even remember how much a can of beans costs. So here you are, and I think you're going to do fine. I'm trying to build you up now so you don't flake out when you get the first round wrong. But here we go. Five rounds. You get three categories in each round. You get to pick which category you want to play. If you get three questions right, then you're the big winner, and you get a prize from the Yahoo and Sportsnet prize closet. There has to be deep negotiation between both companies to determine which prize you receive, but you'll eventually receive it. If you don't, then you'll feel shame, undoubtedly, for not getting the questions right. Are you ready to play Game Show Friday on Thursday, sir?
Born ready, Greg.
Your categories in round one are the New York Islanders sweater numbers, okay, NHL stats, and NHL spelling bee. Which one would you like?
I'm going to go jersey numbers.
Jersey numbers it is. Which one of these players, being that it is February 4th as we do this show, never wore number 4 with the New York Islanders? Never wore number 4. We're looking for the guy who never wore number 4. A, Brian Berard. B, Bob Lorimer. C, Uwe Krupp. D, Zdeno Chara.
Well, to be totally honest, I have no earthly idea. So
I know, super Berard. Exciting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which one are you going to do?
I'm going to go Berard.
That is incorrect.
Yeah,
answer
right.
We were looking for, of course, was Zdeno Chara, number 3 in your programs, number 1 in the hearts of every team he played for except for the Islanders. So that is one wrong. That's all right. It's just the first round. But like I said, don't be the person with the can of beans. Keep focused.
Starting off with a loss
steady.
Is very much in the Islanders' tradition, so I'm ready.
Round two. Your three choices are NHL threesomes, one of the favorite categories here in Game Show Friday on Thursday. NHL trade deadline and all things Jaromír Jágr. Threesomes, trade deadline, all things Jaromír Jágr.
I'll try threesomes.
All right, here we go. I have a good feeling about this one, but let's see. I'm going to name three players. You tell me what the commonality, the primary commonality between these three players is, okay? What ties them together? Your players are Oleg Kvasha, Todd Bertuzzi, and Jacob Markstrom.
All played for the Florida Panthers?
It's true that they did, and now I'm stuck because I know there are going to be people out there that are going to complain that that is the primary bind between them. So I'm going to give you that one only because I don't want the hassle from the Game Show Friday critics. But what I was really looking for was they were all players traded for Roberto Luongo. But I'm going to give you it anyway. Because you technically got it right.
I was thinking that those two were traded by Mike Milbury, but his powers of destruction couldn't really reach Markstrom.
Right, exactly, not yet. Remains to be seen. I mean, there's still a chance he could be like the GM in Vegas or something like that, so we don't know for sure. But you're technically right, and I'll give it to you. I'm in a giving mood because there were a couple of questions last night at Bar Trivia here in the city at Dempsey's that we go to, where we're given the credit despite not being specific. So I'm in a giving mood, so I'll give you that one. So you are one for two.
I'm totally not above winning on a technicality, so thank you.
No, I think that's fine. I think that's the way life should be led. One for two, and here's round three. NHL salaries, Mad Mike Milbury, a category you requested, and a favorite of Game Show Friday, defunct minor league teams.
I got to stick with Mad Mike.
In 1998, the New York Islanders made one of their worst trades under Mike Milbury, which is saying something, trading away defenseman Brian McCabe, center Todd Bertuzzi, and a third-round draft pick that turned out to be Jarkko Ruutu for which veteran forward?
I believe that's Trevor Linden.
That is correct. The Trevor Linden trade is what we were looking for. Jarkko Ruutu, by the way, the draft pick in that one, just to make sure that that trade could be more lopsided, three NHL players for an over-the-hill Trevor Linden. Pretty impressive from Mike Milbury. Now we start remixing the categories a little bit as we get deeper into this thing. So your next round, and keep in mind you are two for three, doing quite well, and only need one more correct answer to win the game. Your third, your next round here is the Stanley Cup, defunct minor league team names, and NHL stats. Which one would you like?
Let's do stats.
All right. This is a good one because this is a pretty cut and dry one, a 50-50 proposition, if you will. And so you might be able to put this game in the bag right here. What's greater, the number of points separating Patrick Kane and Jamie Benn as the number one and two scorers in the National Hockey League, or the number of points that Toronto Maple Leafs forward Joffrey Leupel has on the season?
So I know Kane is up above 70 now. I'm going to go with the Kane-Ben split. I think that's higher.
That is correct. Patrick Kane and Jamie Benn are separated by 16 points, and Joffrey Leupel only has 14 points on the season thus far for your Toronto Maple Leafs. Well, somebody's Toronto Maple Leafs. Whoever is a fan of Veins and Butts, which is the new logo that they have in Toronto, probably is also a fan of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Well, there you go. Three correct answers. You win Game Show Friday on Thursday.
Let's go.
An epic, amazing accomplishment. I'll give you one more bonus question just because I know that there are probably people out there that are dying to hear some Jaromír Jágr trivia, and here it is. In which of these categories is Jaromír Jágr not the current active leader in the National Hockey League? So all active players, Jágr does not lead this category currently. Games played, goals, points per game, or plus minus? Yeah, I know. Tough one, right? Good thing you didn't pick it.
Yeah, well, he has been on some pretty terrible teams over his 97-year career, so I think it's probably got to be plus-minus.
Ah, but those teams weren't always that bad in plus-minus, sir. I mean, you think about those Ranger teams, for example, with Lundqvist, Penguins teams where they scored an F ton of goals around Jágr. So plus-minus, he's actually the current active leader with .302. Goals, obviously, .737. We know where he is in games played. As you said, he plays has played for years and years and years. So the answer we're looking for, points per game average, he is actually fourth among active players at 1.15 points per game. Sidney Crosby, still your leader in that category for active players, with the commensurate number of games Hockey Reference needed for that category, 1.33 points per game for Sid. So Jágr fourth in that category, but pretty much leads in every other active category, including assists and power play points and everything else.
Well, there you go.
You learn a little thing or two on this very podcast, I tell you.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations, Henry. You did a hell of a job. In the remaining moments that we have here on the podcast, what would you like to say to the people?
Sure. I mean, I guess you can follow me on Twitter at Henry A. Decker. I've not really tweeted very much since I left my last job as a journalist, though, so it might be kind of boring. Ooh, you can follow my favorite parody account. I'm not involved in it, but it's hysterical. It's at Garth Foe, sharing the innermost thoughts of current Islanders GM and lifelong light beer enthusiast Garth Snow.
That's very interesting, because I would say the best Islanders parody Twitter is the Islanders SUV one, but you say it's not that one.
I was not aware that was a parody.
Oh, God.
I was thinking of Sparky texting behind the wheel. Okay.
It was obviously the SUV has become sentient and is tweeting from behind the glass in the attacking zone.
About how it can't see the ring from its seats. Yeah, it's tough.
Probably could not. Yeah. Where you said you were a journalist. Where did you work, buddy?
I used to work for the National Memo. It's a great political website and newsletter covering U.S. politics.
So not Talking Points Memo, National Memo.
National Memo.
Okay, interesting. All right.
Just give them a look also for those who are interested in this 2016 campaign. A lot of good coverage there.
Yeah. I don't see any reason to. You don't write there anymore. But it's fine. If you people want to check it out, I suppose they can. Thank you so much for playing along, sir. Thanks for listening to the podcast. We're happy to have made your vacation all the more relaxing by putting you through the ringer and you coming out okay.
All right. Thanks for having me, Greg.
There he goes. Henry Decker is a cop, and he's hunting replicants. Blade Runner 2. Blade Runnering. Thanks to Pat Steinberg for joining us on Sportsnet 960, Sam? Is that right? All right. I never know my station numbers when I do. I just group everything under Sportsnet Radio or TSN Radio. I think most of Canada's that way, too. What are you watching? Just TSN. It could be like TSN 50, showing some, like, AHL game. But just it's TSN in general, I'm sure. Thanks to Kent Wilson, brilliant guy. Follow him on Twitter. Always good with the fancy stats and with the insights into the Calgary Flames. And thanks to Henry Decker for all the game show excitement that finished off the show. Back Monday, probably Monday. Super Bowl's Sunday, so I doubt we're going to do a show then. So back Monday in some capacity. Tomorrow I'm off of DC for a little bit. And there you go. Follow me on Twitter at Wyshynski. Hashtag at MVSW if you want to say anything about the show. And all that jive. And me and Merrick back Monday, most likely. Thanks, everybody. Have a great... Oh, and thanks, everybody, again, for all this amazing stuff that happened at the All-Star Game and for supporting the John Scott thing. I know I've said that before this week, but I'll end the week reiterating that it was a really cool time for all involved. Really cool that you came out and said hey at the Flying Saucer. And also really cool that all of your support for the Scott campaign worked out the way it did for Scott and for the NHL. So there you go. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you soon. Bye. Oh, thanks, Sam. Also, bye.